Sa'adaram.
Along with respect.
Datam.
Which was offered.
Sapayam.
Worship, adoration.
Baram.
Presence.
Asanam.
A seat.
Cha.
And.
Sa.
She.
Sati.
Na
adata.
Did not accept.
Pitra.
By her father.
Apratinandita.
Not being welcomed.
Sati.
Sati. Translation, although she was received by her sisters and mother, she did not reply to their words of reception. Although she was offered a seat and presence, she did not accept anything, for her father neither talked with her nor welcomed her by asking about her welfare. So you can repeat, although she was received,
by her sisters and mother, she did not reply to their words of reception.
And although she was offered a seat in presence,
she did not accept anything.
For her father neither talked with her,
nor welcomed her,
by asking about her welfare.
So purport by his divine grace,
Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Sati did not accept the greetings offered by her sisters and mother, for she was not at all satisfied by her father's silence. Sati was the youngest child of Daksha, and she knew that she was his pet. But now, because of her association with Lord Shiva, Daksha forgot all his affection for his daughter, and this very much aggrieved her. The material bodily conception is so polluted that even upon slight provocation, all our relationships of love and affection are nullified. Bodily relations are so transient that even though one is affectionate towards someone in a bodily relationship, a slight provocation terminates this intimacy. Heavy purport.
Sadaya samprasna samartha vartaya matraja matri swashri vishya sadhar satsaram datam saparyam varam hasanam chitsa nadatta pitra pratinandita sati.
So om gana timadanda sha gananjana shlakaya chakshurin meditam yena tasmai shi gurave namaha. So I think we should analyze why these material relationships actually are so transitory or transient, as Srila Prabhupada stated, and why there's definitely agitation in these material relationships or anger in the material relationships. First of all, what is the definition of a material relationship? What is the definition of material consciousness? Material consciousness means I'm thinking of me. Actually, two things. I and mine. These are two divisions of the false ego. That I am the center of everything. Ishwaroham aham bhogi siddham balavan sukhi. This is mentioned by Krishna in the Gita. I'm perfect, powerful, happy, you know, etc. And then mine. This is mine. Just like you see a little kid, you know, holding them. This is mine. My toys. You got your toys. These are my toys. So anyway, so we have the sense of possession. Of course, the sense of possession begins with the sense of possession of this body. You know, we actually think this is my body to enjoy. So therefore, you have such things as, you know, the abortion movement says, you know, this is my body. You know, don't tell me what to do with it. But actually, what claim do we have to ownership of this body? I mean, just like practically speaking, if you own a piece of land, you know, you've paid some money for it or whatever, and you get a title certificate, they can do a title search to make sure. Actually, it's funny, because so many people have owned it before. If you ever bought a piece of property, they do this title search, and there's this big book, and it lists everybody who's owned the property for the last, you know, 200 years in America, and probably in Europe the last 1,000 years or something. And it's just interesting. And each one of those persons thought that they owned the property. They thought, it's my house. My house. It's like, you know, even some ISKCON temples in Europe, they were actually in castles before, like the castle in France. Or, for example, our temple in Ljubljana, that's Slovenia, for those of you who don't know, was previously owned by the Nazis in World War II. And the Nazis were thinking, this is our property. And, of course, they used the temple for so many nefarious things, which don't need to be described in Bhagavatam class. You know, they killed people downstairs in the temple. You know, there's still some rooms we haven't opened up yet, you know, because we're afraid of what we might find down there. Anyway, so it's true. Sometimes devotees claim there's ghosts in the temple. And there may be ghosts in the temple, so you better chant Hare Krishna better. You know, because there may be some people who... And there's actually a statue right outside the front door of the temple of a man who's running away from the temple. When I first got there, I thought, well, you should put some... Anyway, he didn't have any clothes on. So I said, you should put some kopins on him at least. But they said, this is a national monument because this is the person who escaped from them. You understand? Anyway, it's very interesting. So so they thought they owned it. Anyway, the title certificate, but at least you paid for it, so you have some rights, legal rights. But basically, what legal rights do you have over your body? I mean, you didn't pay for it. The ingredients were provided by Krishna, basically. You could say the ingredients were provided by the parents, but they weren't provided by the parents. The parents had some relationship, and the ingredients came from outside. You know, the parents had to eat. So it all came from God, in other words. God is the owner. Krishna is the owner. Ishvara Sarvabhutam. He's the owner. He's the controller of everything. And so basically, we don't even have ownership of this body. You know, what to speak of other things. It's my body. And we don't have a right to use the body any way we see fit. Just like if you're borrowing someone's car. I get very nervous when I borrow someone's car. Just like I was in Orlando. And the devotee there said, you know, you can borrow my car. It happened to be a Mercedes. So I was thinking, I don't want to borrow it. You know, even though I may love to drive around a Mercedes, but I said, I don't want to borrow it because it's his. You know, I'll be nervous about it because he mentioned previously some devotees came there and one devotee had an accident with his car and he's being sued for $100,000, you know, because of the accident. Because if you own a car in America, even if you're the driver, you don't get sued. It's the owner of the car that actually gets sued for it. So I was thinking, if I'm going to take this car out, you know, I may take it out, and I didn't take it out. But if I'm going to take it out, I'm going to be extremely careful about it, you know, just like more careful than I'd be with my own car. My own car. So anyway, that's interesting too. Because I understood it was his car. You know, so you're real careful when you're borrowing something. At least I am. I mean, some people aren't, but at least I am very careful, you know, because I know if I break it, I have to pay for it or whatever like that. So basically, because, and you don't use it, you know, if you're an honest person, you're not going to use it for purposes that go against the owner's purpose. He's lending it to you for a specific reason. So, in other words, we've been lent these material elements, which actually come from Krishna. We've been lent this intelligence, the brain. We've been lent everything else we have. You know, we've been given a quota, as is stated in the Isopanishad, everyone has a quota. Everyone is given a quota. Some people are given a more quota than others, and we'd like to have their quota. Sometimes we look at other people's quota and think, boy, I wish I had that quota. I wish I had the Mercedes quota or the BMW quota or something. But anyway, so it's all Krishna's though. He's just lending it to us. So we don't have a right of proprietorship over anything. And it said in the Gita, Nirmana Moha Jita Sangha Josha Avyatma Nitya Vinivritta Kama. The way to get over this, out of this material world, is to understand basically, be free of false prestige, free of the concept of ownership, that we own anything. Jitta Sangha Dosha, free of bad association. I mean, this is Krishna's injunction in the 15th chapter of the Gita, after he describes the entanglement of the material world in terms of a banyan tree. That's very, very entangling. He says, this is the way to get out of this banyan tree, this entangling banyan tree that has the branches down and the roots up, backside, upside down, backside, whatever. So, first of all, we don't own anything, including the body. But the concept that we own something causes us to actually have bad relationships with other people. That's one thing, ownership, and also I'm the enjoyer of something, I and mine, etc., like that. So getting back to the point, so material relationships means I form a relationship to own something or to enjoy something. And of course, the loving relationships in this world, generally, I'm not saying that completely like that. I don't want to fry everybody out. But generally, they're like that because, you know, people choose someone who titillates their senses. I mean, it's actually due to certain hormones acting in a certain way in the body. You know, just practically. I mean, we choose not only people, but we choose animals, you know, whatever. Let's say we want a pet. We choose a pet that pleases our senses. I mean, very few people have pet cockroaches. I don't think I've met anyone with a pet cockroach.
In the ashram, but
they're not pets. I mean, it's not that you take them and pet them and kiss them and everything like that. I mean, you want to get rid of them because they don't please your senses. So there's an animosity towards them because they're not pleasing to your senses. And a nice, like, furry cat or a furry dog or a furry human being, you know. You know, that is a lady with nice hair on her or something like that. Just like for ladies, I mean, just like the important thing is taking care of the hair. I mean, why hair? I mean, what's hair? Anyway, I mean, what is hair? Hair is something that attracts people, you know. That's all. I mean, otherwise, I mean, sometimes they have weird hair, like the spiked hair and everything like that. You ever seen that? You go to Europe someplace and everybody's walking around with spiked hair. But so some people are attracted by that. Oh, I love your spiked hair. Just don't butt me with it because I don't. Because it would kill me. You know, I guess it's a weapon like the bulls have their horns. You know, so nowadays people like that and some lady kills you, she doesn't like you. Anyways, or men also have spiked hair, but. Anyway, so we like something because it pleases us. That's not really love. That's not really compassion. I mean, just to be honest about the whole thing, it's just something pleases us. We like it. That's all. And then and we could enjoy that particular thing. So getting back to this particular instance, you know, obviously, you know, the child represents the parents. The parents have a sense of ownership of the child. The child pleases the parents and somebody, especially when they're real young. When they get a little older, it's a different story. When they're real young, they're real cute and everything like that. And it's very pleasant, you know, pet child. Well, that's what's being described here. So, but if that same child or husband or wife or not only in family life or pet does something that displeases you, or let us say it aggravates you, because it doesn't meet your needs anymore. Because you're actually, I mean, just speaking in an NVC context, you're actually demanding that person fulfill your needs. You know, I got married, dude, it's your business to do this. Or, you know, or the cat, it's your business to curl up on my lap. and purr, purr, baby, purr. Isn't it? I mean, what if your cat, instead of purring, gets angry and, rah, 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 and scratches you? Not only scratches you out of love, but this is a useless cat, you know, get rid of it. So, and you see people interacting with different animals based upon how they please you. I mean, like a cow, it pleases someone by eating, you know, so they kill the cow. Whereas a dog pleases you by being obsequious, which means it tries to please you, you know, directly. So you interact with them in different ways. A cow you'll kill, a dog you'll take as a pet. And if someone kills a dog, they get arrested. If someone takes a cow into their house, they'll also get arrested as a pet. Because it's illegal in the city, you know, to have a cow as a pet. So, I mean, it's just based upon how they please you. So, anyway. So getting to the point, when someone or something pleases us, we sort of demand the satisfaction from that person. And when they don't, the indicator that it's a demand is that we get angry when they don't please. That's actually what differentiates a demand from a request, isn't it? That we get angry when they don't please us, like that. And so here you see a perfect example of that. That Sati was not pleasing her father anymore because she happened to have a husband that he didn't care for, and that was Lord Shiva. So he definitely said, "You're not my daughter anymore." He was thinking like that. "You're not my daughter. You're married with that Lord Shiva. I don't want to see your face." He didn't even recognize her or show that he recognized her in this particular instance. And you see this happening. There's other stories like that in the Vedic tradition. I mean, the typical story that comes to mind is the story of Hiranyakashipu and Prahlad Maharaj. The Hiranyakashipu was very loving towards Prahlad Maharaj. I mean, it's not that it's not that he had animosity. You know, when Prahlad was born, you know, of course you may have been in your mother's womb when in the ashram of Narada Muni, but we'll forgive you for that. So when he was born, I'm sure he was like cuddling him and everything like that, and rock-a-bye Prahlad on the treetop. You know, he had other sons. He had Prahlad, Samlad, I mean, and he had four sons, actually. So I'm sure he was very loving. But as soon as Prahlad did something that didn't please him, immediately, you know, there's this like, get this creep out of here. You know, in the beginning, of course, was just get him out of here and re-educate him, you know. Because he said things to his father that didn't please him. Like his father said, "What's the best thing you learned at school?" You know, just like we say that to people too. When children come and see us, we say, what are you studying at school, my dear little child? You know, the parents bring the child to see me, or the children come, and I say, "What are you studying in school?" And Prahlad said, "Dad, when I'm studying," basically the first thing he said, and one of the things he said was Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam. He said that when I'm studying, what I'm learning, not from my teachers, is to hear, chant, remember, worship the Supreme Personality of God. He gave the Nava Bhakti process or processes. Isn't that, can you imagine that? He comes home from school and says, "Dad, I've learned you should hear and chant and remember and worship, offer everything, become a friend to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. What do you think about that, Daddy?" And Daddy wasn't too happy with him, you know. Daddy, Hiranyakashipu, gold cushion. Anyway, he said to the teachers, "You know, you got to take him back. I don't want to see this guy again until you rectified him." And then he also said at another time, "You know, Dad, you should take sannyas, you know. Matiram and Krishna Padatos Vatova Matovit Padyeta Grahavratanam and Dandagopir Vishatam Tamashram Punat Punas Charvitam." I think, you know, you're just chewing the chew, Daddy. In other words, you're just trying to squeeze some enjoyment out of something that has no enjoyment. You know, it's time to head for the hills, take sannyas or take vanaprastha at least, Dad. And so, you know, his father was throwing him off his lap. Previously, he was loving him so much. And then he threw him off his lap. And finally, you know, he compared him to, like, I guess a dog's tail or something, that even though you try to straighten it, it just curls up again, or a dog or a pig's tail. And then he said, there's nothing that could be done with you. You know. And then finally, and then he tried to kill him anyway. There's so many other things that happened. He tried to kill his son in so many ways, you know, throwing him off a cliff, putting him under the elephants, and poisoning him, having his mother poison him. And Prahlad Maharaj was just like, and that was aggravating him even more, that he couldn't kill his kid. And finally, you know, we know the story. He hit a pillar because Prahlad Maharaj said, God is everywhere, he's in the pillar, and Lord Nrsingadev came out and killed him. So there's a story of a loving relationship that turns sour. And there's other stories too. I mean, if you think about it, there's so many stories about this. Don't even have to draw stories from the modern day and age. I mean, there's a story of when Arjuna was in the heavenly planets, and he was learning martial arts and also dancing. He became a dancing teacher. And he was seen by this beautiful girl, Urvasi. And Urvasi, you know, she became smitten by him. That means smitten means fell in love. For those of you who don't know what smitten means. Enamored. So anyway, so she went up to Arjuna. And one night, you know, Arjuna was in his house resting peacefully. Hears a knock on the door. He said, who's there? And she says, it's Urvasi, you know, with a nice celestial, attractive voice. Urvasi, honey. And so he answers the door, and Urvasi's there. And he said, oh, hi, Urvasi. She said, what? He said, what do you want? She said, I love you. And then, you know, and Arjuna, you know, didn't want anything to do with it because she was actually the not forefather, foremother of the whole Kuru dynasty, you know, basically her and Pururava. So he just basically said, "Oh, Mataji, you're just like my mother." And she said, "Huh? On the heavenly planets, we don't have these rules like this. You know, heavenly planets, anybody can have a relationship with anyone else." You know, she started to get angry at that point. You know, it's interesting. I mean, it was, you know, love 1 second and the next one. Because she wanted to enjoy him. It's not that she wanted to please him. You know, if you really want to please someone, you ask them, what can I do to please you? Yeah, that, huh. People don't ask that usually. Or like our famous president, John F. Kennedy, said, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. That's interesting. And we actually have to say the same statement, don't ask what Krishna can do for you, but what you can do for Krishna. So anyway, so very few people ask, you know, what can I do to please you? And with sincerity. I mean, some people ask it, you know, with manipulative conception. What can I do to please you? And the person says, can you do that? And they said, well, not that. Can I do something else to please you? Not that. Not that. Do you have a third choice? But anyway. I mean, it's really interesting how people interact like that. So anyway, so she became very angry at Arjuna, instead of asking him how he could, she could please him. So that what's that love? Isn't it, what's that love? It just transformed into wrath. It was actually lust. That's the point. The Gita tells us that this love, this romantic stuff, you know, that everybody is just like dying to experience. Even though if you're 50, 60, 80 years old, you're still dying to experience. I mean, I said that with my grandmother when she was in the old people's home. She asked me, you know, there was like a 95-year-old man. Is he, do you think he's the man for me? I don't know. It was hard for me to relate to the whole thing, you know. Is he the man for me? So anyway, so I said, aren't you a little old for these things, Ma, Grandma? She said, never too old. Anyway, so there's actually romance going on in the old people's homes, whether you know it or not. So Krishna says, getting back to the point, Krishna says that the lust means that you're trying to enjoy. When you're trying to enjoy something, you contemplate something. This is standard Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, Gita. Jayato Vishak Pumsa. That the person, Jayato, Jaya, Jhana, contemplates. It's something like meditation, Jhana. Just like Jhana Yoga. Jhana Yoga means meditative yoga. Right? There's jnana yoga and jhana, D-H-Y-A-N-A. Jhana means to meditate. So you're meditating on something. Jayato vishaya. Vishaya means the object of the senses. And then by that contact, sangha tesho pajayate. Sangha, just like we have sangha. You know, saru sangha means association with devotees. Sanghutesha bhajayate, then becomes born. Jayate means to be born, or it's comes out. You understand? Like Krishna Jayanti means when Krishna appeared. Jayato Vishal. So, Sanghutesha bhajayate. Sangat. From that Sangha associates Sangat. Sanjayate becomes born again. Sanjayate. Kama. Comes lust. Now lust is the opposite of love. Sangat, sanjayate, kama. Kama, and then unfortunately after that kama, after the Kama Sutra, comes, oh my God, anger. Kama, krodha, vijayate, becomes born. You understand? It's a very interesting verse in the second chapter of the Gita. Kama, krodha, vijayate. Sangat, sanjayate, kama, kama, krodha, vijayate. And then from lust comes anger. Anger comes bewilderment of memory. From bewilderment of memory, anyway, one loses his own, his intelligence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all that comes from the attempts to enjoy the world, lust. I mean, lust can also be explained not only in terms of, you know, like the romantic relationship, which we sannyasis like to talk about, but it becomes anything we want to enjoy, you know, whether it's even a computer or a car or anything that we think is ours, any relationship, bodily relationship, mental relationship, like that. And then it becomes transformed into anger, wrath, which is the old devouring enemy of this world. Anyway, so that's Gita. So, okay. So I wanted to talk about how to deal with this whole thing. And then tell an interesting story from the Bhagavatam that illustrates it. Okay, so there's an interesting story in Bhagavatam that illustrates how to deal with this lust. That once upon a time, there was this lady, Diti. And she, of course, is the mother of all the daichas. That means the nice guys. No, that means the demons. So anyway. But they're nice. Actually, these demons are not like, you know, you picture, you know, you hear the word demon, you think like people with horns on their heads, you know, running around with claws. They're very cultured people. They have Brahmins, they worship the Brahmins, just like Shukracharya, they have their guru. You know, they're just not, you know, they have their concerts and everything like that. You know, that you have classical music, they play Bach. I mean, it's just like, you know, it doesn't mean they're just running around like fiends. Fiends and demons are not the same thing. Anyway, so, and sometimes they even worship Krishna. So what happens? So anyway, she was the mother of the demons. They're nice. I mean, I'm empathic with them. I love them. You know, just clarify things. So she was the mother, and she was really angry with the person who she thought was responsible for the death of her sons, because, you know, she had such cute sons as Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. And so, who did she blame? Who did she blame for the death of her sons? Indra. Because for Indra's sake, Vishnu was doing his thing. You know, she was intelligent enough not to get angry with Vishnu. Although we find people getting angry with Vishnu too, but she, at least she had the brains, you know, not to get angry with Vishnu. All right. So what happened is that she thought, you know, she got really angry with Vishnu, with Indra. And she thought, I got to make a plan to kill Indra. And so she went to, she wasn't powerful enough to take care of Indra herself. So her husband, does anyone remember her husband's name? Starts with a K. Kashyapa. She thought, he's powerful enough. So she went and did her thing, a romantic thing with him. And brought him flowers and everything like that. And was very nice to him. What does the Prabhupada say? Too much devotion is a sign of a thief. So she did her thing and he said, oh, my dear wife, you love me so much. What do you want? Anything you want, I'll give you. He became enamored. And she said, you know, I just want to kill Indra. I have a son who kills Indra. And he said, I better be careful, you know, about, you know, being bewildered by someone who, you know, serves me and everything like that. So he thought for a second, all right, let's do something that will change your mentality. He actually gave her devotional service to perform. And it was really strict devotional service. I mean, she couldn't rest at certain times. She couldn't eat at certain times. She had to do a puja at times. I mean, it was really austere for a whole year. And he said, if you deviate from this, you know, you're going to get some kids who were Indra's friends. So just to check to make sure, or to see what mistakes she was making, you know, to make sure that she made mistakes, Indra came along. And he was serving her because she is his aunt. You understand? They're related because Aditi, who is Indra's mother, is the sister of Diti. And so there, you know, there's aunt and nephew, you know. So he was the aunt trying to kill her nephew. Understandable because her kids were killed by the nephew's friend, Krishna. And actually, Krishna is even named after Indra. Did you know that? Upendra. Upendra means like little Indra or close to Indra, like that. Upendra is the name of Vamandev. So anyway, she was doing her sacrifice and Indra was serving. He said, I just want to serve you, my dear aunt. And so as she was performing the sacrifice, she was actually becoming purified by devotional service. And then also, she did make a mistake towards the end of the whole month. And Indra thought, oh, I'll take advantage to kill her kid then. And so he went into her womb, you know, tried to do an abortion. He made himself real small, entered in, and sliced up the kid into 7 pieces. But something about demigods, when you slice up their kids into 7 pieces, each of the pieces is a separate kid. And so they were all crying in the womb. I don't know if they were crying, but at least they, because you can't cry out loud there. And so he did it again. He sliced each of the 7 pieces into 7 pieces, and there were 49 kids. Now that's a real litter. Understand, litter? I mean, did anyone ever deliver in the hospital 49 kids from one lady? That would be remarkable, isn't it? You know, being the USA Today, CNN, and people would be complaining she's putting such a burden on society by having 49 kids at one time. Anyway, so these 49 actually became Indra's friends. They became the Maruts, the wind demigods. And she, after performing, the point of the story is that after performing this devotional service, she actually loved Indra and no longer hated him. So that's the point. That's the point I'm getting to. If one performs devotional service, it's not that you can get out of bodily attachment just by getting out of it. You can't do a negative. You know, how many times have I tried in the past to tell people, you're too attached. Stop being so attached. Never worked. Not even once. So the point is Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Janayati Asu Vairagram Jnanam Cha Yada Hoitukam. That if one performs devotional service, automatically detachment comes by hearing and chanting. So we don't force people. It's like trying to force someone to give birth, or trying to force an egg, you know, the bird to come out of the egg before the little chicken or the bird is actually mature, right? It's just like that. There's another story, like Vinata, she had two eggs. And one egg, you know, what was it, 50,000 years or something, or 50 million years, long time, the egg didn't hatch. And so she broke it open, and the little bird was half formed. And that little bird cursed his mother, actually, went away. Anyway, that was Aruna. Anyway, the whole story about the demigods. So anyway, so we have to allow people to develop naturally this detachment. Until that time, what do you do until that time? Just tolerate? Yeah. But until that time, we have principles of dharma. You understand? Duty. So one sticks to their duty and dharma, regardless of what the mind is saying in terms of sense gratification. So that actually keeps society stable. Unless people have a sense of dharma and they're not completely Krishna conscious, society will fall apart completely. And most people are not Krishna conscious. I was talking to people last night and I said, what do you expect? You know, they say there's so many problems in the movement politics, and I said, what do you expect? Then we're not all Krishna conscious. So until that time, dharma is there. Okay? All glories to the Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.